The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com. Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, March 13, 2019, and this is the Bob Seska Show, interviews from Earth One. 45 years ago, this month, the greatest rock band in history, Rush, released their self-titled debut album. My guest today, Donna Halper, is the former rock radio DJ who first introduced the band to America on a radio station in Cleveland, Ohio, WMMS. From there, Donna went on to become a professor of political communication and media studies, as well as an author and a blogger. In other words, between Rush and her political expertise, Donna is the perfect guest for this show. Today, we'll talk a little politics and a lot of Rush. And if you like what you hear, please support the show by subscribing at BobSeskaShow.com. And now, here comes the great Donna Halper.
Didn't do it, but I know who did.
Hi, Donna. It's Bob. How are you?
Oh, God, I'm just looking at some of those tweets. I mean, haters gotta hate. We're living in this world. We're living in Trump world. I mean, people argue at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? This week, Donna, has been especially crazy for Twitter.
I've just noticed that people
are out of control. And I think, I don't know if it's Mercury in retrograde or what's going on, but every once in a while you get these weeks where maybe it's the butterfly effect, too. Maybe it's just the ricocheting nature of the ill will and anger eventually infects
everyone. I think people feel overwhelmed. I mean, you were talking about this with Stephanie.
Right.
People feel like they're out of control. They feel like there's no justice. They feel like everything out there is unfair. They feel like victims. They feel aggrieved. Yep. And they have a president who tells them that it's all somebody else's fault. So what else could you do but get on Twitter and express your outrage, you know?
That's right. That's
what
right.
he does.
Yeah.
What he does.
And what was your reaction to the Manafort sentencing? I mean, while it seems light, he's actually getting a far stiffer sentence than most of the Watergate guys.
I look at, for example, the Jefferson sentencing, which has been talked about before, for the guy from Louisiana who had the cash in his freezer. Let's see. Now, what was the difference between him and Manafort? Let me see if I can. I just can't think what the difference might be, okay?
Could it be?
Could it be Satan?
I was the chair
in Cleveland, Ohio. I was chair of the Prisoners' Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Oh, that's great.
I worked with a wonderful guy named Gordon Beggs. I don't know if he's still alive, but we worked to change the marijuana laws.
Yeah.
And I say that kindly because I don't smoke, okay? Never have. But in Cleveland, in Ohio at that time, the penalty for marijuana was 7 years in jail.
Wow.
The penalty for manslaughter was 5.
Oh, okay? My God.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, so you look at stuff like that and you think to yourself, boy, howdy, look at this scandal with the rich people getting their kids into the good schools. Look at Manafort getting a lighter sentence than a black or a Hispanic defendant would get for doing far less.
Yep.
And no wonder people are frustrated.
Yeah,
no wonder people are lashing out. I mean, they feel, you know, they really do, I think, in many ways, feel powerless. And this is their catharsis. It's sad, but this is their catharsis. Now we got to get them to get out there and vote, for heaven's sake.
You're so right.
Are we podcasting? Are we?
Yes, we're already, we are well underway.
We are podcasting.
Yep.
We are doing our thing. Okay, 100%. Now we've already offended all these people who tuned in to hear about Rush, and it's like, oh my God. God, she said something about Donald Trump. I'm tuning out.
Yeah, good luck with that. You know,
okay.
That's invariably going to happen. But, I mean, we're going to talk about politics here for a little bit.
Can I just be real clear about something? One of the things I've always loved about Rush is how they bring people together.
Yep.
There are people who are righties. There are people who are lefties. There are people who are atheists, believers, whatever. Mm-hmm. But you can all unite around the music.
Yeah.
And it's, to me, one of the greatest things that the band gave us, okay? And we can talk about politics. We can talk about this and that. But the key to being a Rush fan, being a part of that extended Rush family, is thinking for yourself and choosing, you know, if you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice.
That's right.
And so you can't be on the sidelines. And if the only thing you can do is rage tweet, you know, you're kind of missing the point.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah, and you know, Rush is always there. At least earlier on, well, you know, even now, even with Snakes and Arrows and some of their more recent work, they've always had little teeny tiny dalliances with politics and some of the messages of especially Neil's lyrics.
Absolutely, one of the things Neil told me back, you know, I would be lying to you if I said that Neil were my best pal ever. He's not. Okay, Neil always was a very private person.
Sure.
But on a few occasions, we had some great conversations, and he said the thing that frustrated him the most was the fact that people expected him to have the same views he had back in the 1970s.
Right.
Okay? He was like, you know, he was a big Ayn Rand fan, and, you know, he would quote from the novels and this and that, and he said, and then he moved on.
Yeah.
Okay, as we all do. One of the things that just completely upsets me about politics and about life in general is we take something that somebody said back in 1980 and it's like, oh my God, they said blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I think every last one of us, including you and me, can look at stuff that we said 20, 30, 40 years ago, and it's like, what was I thinking?
Oh my God,
okay?
Yes.
So if you're going to hold against me, only in politics do we do this. Only in politics, yeah. And whether you're a Joe Biden fan or not, okay? The guy's been in politics since forever, okay? Mm. I mean, I think I was a baby when he first got into politics.
Yeah, no
you
doubt.
Know, I was like kicking the slats out of my crib when he first got into politics.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact remains, we've all said stuff, and we all moved on. So that's what Neil was talking about. He said, just because I used to believe X, and now I no longer believe it, I'm not a traitor to my cause.
That's right.
I'm somebody who got new information, looked at it, and said, huh, oh crap, I just don't want to be where I was. I want to be somewhere else. Why is that wrong?
That's part of being an intellectual. I have always said that learning new information and changing your opinions with the addition of new facts. This is the way people progress as intellectuals.
I've said to my students, and I'm very upfront about it, I did not used to believe in marriage equality. Okay, I never believed in discriminating against gay people or anything like that, but coming from the generation I came from, I never thought gay people wanted to get married.
Right.
I was taught that I was taught they didn't.
I still don't understand why they do.
There you go.
Right.
But my point is, I wasn't like, oh my God, I hate them and I want to see them punished.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh, I didn't know they wanted to get married. Oh, okay.
Right.
You know, and once I got some new information and once I met some people, including some people I worked with who had been in long-term relationships, and all they wanted was for the state to recognize their relationship.
Yep.
And I started thinking about it and I said, wow, why should they have fewer rights than I do? I mean, it just didn't make sense anymore.
Absolutely.
So I became a supporter of marriage equality. Now, should you hold against me the fact that, oh my God, in 1985, you said you didn't believe in it? Well, neither did anybody else, if you want to be honest about it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't the common wisdom. So you study up on it, you admit that you got it wrong, and then you move on.
Yeah.
But nope, we're going to hold every single thing that Joe Biden ever said, or we're going to take Neil and say, well, my God, you're a traitor to Ayn Rand. Who wants to live like
sure.
that?
I mean, 30 years ago, Donna, I was a Republican. I mean, the first campaign
now,
that
see,
I worked on as a
volunteer. I knew there was something I didn't like about you, okay? I knew there was something. I, you know?
Yep.
We're done now. Okay, this interview is over. Okay?
Yeah, I mean, in 1989.
See if I ever talk to you again.
I was listening to 2112 on endless loop and working for the George H.W. Bush campaign in 1988,
and I don't hold that against you for 1 minute.
And I founded the Young Republicans Club at my high school. And yep. But you know what? As soon as I hit academia, as soon as I hit college, you know, it's kind of cliche to say it, but I learned what the world was really like. And suddenly that all melted away and I became, you know, sort of an early embryonic form of the liberal that you hear before you now. But
I just wish that somebody would take back the Republican Party. I mean, it is just, as somebody from Massachusetts, I am accustomed to having candidates in the Republican Party who were principled, who stayed out of my bedroom, who were fiscally conservative but socially liberal. We've had a whole bunch of governors like that, and that's kind of what I got used to.
Yeah.
This bunch, God bless them, I mean, they are just so, you know, they talk about small government, except when it comes to women, in which case suddenly it's big intrusive government.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I sit there and I go, like, what happened to the Republican Party?
Well, I mean, your field of study, Donna, is so germane to everything that's happening right now. You're a professor of political communication and media studies. And what a time. What a time to be in that field, huh?
Yes. And unfortunately, we are living in a time where it becomes so easy to dog whistle people. I mean, I sent you a couple of tweets about the fact that I was mystified when the president said, oh, yeah, you know, the Democrats hate the Jews. I'm like, really?
Yeah.
You know, like this from somebody who said that there were such fine people on both sides in Charlottesville, and who dog whistles about George Soros and who talks about the Jews and money. At some point we'll have the long conversation about how you can disagree with the policies of your government and yet not be anti whatever. So as a friendly Jewish feminist, I can tell you, I do not feel like the Democratic Party hates the Jews.
Yeah.
I do feel like the Democratic Party has some real issues with the policies of the right-wing government in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't strike me as being a horrible thing. I had problems when there was a left-wing government. As a thinking person, I mean, I really liked Barack Obama. It was great to be able to vote for him. But boy, howdy, there were things I didn't agree with that he did.
Sure.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, does that mean I hate my country? This minimalism, it's just like reducing everything to either you're with us, that whole Bush thing, either you're with us or you're against us.
Yeah.
Life is shades of gray.
Yeah.
I would bet you if you and I had lunch, which I hope we will someday.
Sure, yeah.
I would bet you if we had lunch, there would be things that you and I are like totally on the same page about.
Mm-hmm.
There would be other things that's like, I don't know. And then there are other things like, well, I better go do some reading.
Yeah.
But I never expect that every person I talk to is going to either totally agree with me or they're just swine. I just don't. Yeah, what am I missing? Tell me what I'm missing. You know more than I do. You're on the Stephanie Miller show sometimes. What am I missing?
I mean, I think just from my point of view, and really this is all about you, Donna, that this is a matter of, I think, a lot of people just wanting to save face and not wanting to admit, hey, listen, that person over there who I normally disagree with, they actually said something that kind of makes sense. Maybe I'll give them a little bit of credit for that. That's not happening anymore. And certainly I'm not going to exclude myself from that kind of school of thought. But I mean, I think social media.
I just try to be courteous.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I know I have some bad habits and I know that some people hate me, but the reality is if you look back on my social media footprint, you'll find that I'm generally courteous. When people start calling me names, we're kind of finished. Okay. Cause I just can't go for that. But as far as an exchange of ideas, I talk to anybody that wants to talk to me.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I? I subscribe to all kinds of stuff. I don't have to agree with something to want to know how people feel about it. And it seems to me that we've gotten so into confirmation bias. You mentioned earlier I teach political communication and media studies. When I was growing up, okay, and then the dinosaurs came, I know. But when I was growing up, there was a world where we all shared the same facts. You had ABC, NBC, CBS. You had public broadcasting. There were, okay, fine, a limited number of places on television and radio to get your information, but there were always all kinds of magazines, all kinds of newspapers, and people talked about issues. Now, did they always understand them? No, there was an over-reliance on official sources and stuff like that. But my point is, there was at least a shared set of facts. And, well, Daniel Patrick Moynihan was not the first person to say this. He's credited with it. But, you know, the thing about everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but no one's entitled to their own facts. But today we're living in a world where people think they're entitled to their own facts, where the president and other politicians, let's be honest, say, I never said such and such. And then you show them the tape. It's like, nope, nope, I still never said it. Okay, but we're looking right at it. Nope, absolutely not. I never said it. So I mean, you have people just seeking out information that reinforces what they already believe, whether it's a fact or not. And that is so frustrating.
Absolutely. You know, as a political communications expert, Donna, how damaging do you think Trump's tweets are? His public behavior, his style of communication, and that goes in terms of the content of what he's saying and how he says it. How destructive is that to the American discourse, knowing that the president really sets the tone for
his era? You're making my point. Now, we're going to lose a whole bunch of the people that tuned in to hear about Rush because they're going to be like, oh, my God, she's a Democrat.
They can fast forward to the Rush stuff.
Yeah,
that's fine.
But the reality is the guys in Rush are thinking individuals. I've had so many great political conversations with Alex and to a lesser degree with Getty and Neil. Mostly we just talked about music. But the fact remains, we have talked about issues on a few occasions. And the truth is that we used to have a communication from politicians that, it wasn't always honest. You know that old joke about how do you tell when a politician is lying?
Their mouth is moving.
His lips are moving. So, okay, fine. I get it. Politicians lie, okay? The sun will come up, the sun will go down, and politicians will lie. I get it. But there was a certain discourse. There was a certain way of communicating. I cannot for the life of me picture Dwight Eisenhower, or even for that matter, Ronald Reagan, two people who I did not agree with on policy, but I cannot picture either of them getting on social media if it had existed in their day and calling their opponents rude names. I cannot picture either of them going to a political conference and saying BS or saying, you know, other swear words. I can't picture it. I can't picture them autographing Bibles. I'm very serious. The tone has all become a giant reality show and professional wrestling mixed together, okay? So in professional wrestling, you have a good guy who's very, very good, and you have a bad guy who's very, very bad, and the president talks about the other side, anybody that disagrees with him, like they are cartoon villains who must be destroyed. And the problem with that is it not only cheapens the discourse, but it encourages particularly kids. I mean, they are measuring something now in political science called the Trump effect, where kids are talking to each other that way. I don't mind if politicians have strong feelings. Fine with me. But I'm not used to having the leader of the country calling people names like a schoolyard bully.
Yeah.
I'm not used to it.
Is this done? Okay. Is this a lack of understanding by voters in terms of how presidents are supposed to be? I mean, have we been jaded by Fox News Channel, AM Talk Radio, and so on to believe that it's okay for our leadership at the uppermost levels to behave like radio pundits or Fox News screamers?
Well, jaded is the wrong word.
Yeah.
Primed.
Indoctrinated.
Okay. I'll tell you my theory on this, and this is just my theory, and with my theory and a subway token, you can get downtown, okay? The fact remains, the Democrats were very late to the party when it came to talk radio or when it came to setting up any kind of infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I know that on the right, my righty friends believe scrupulously that the Democratic National Committee controls everything and that the media are liberal. And I keep saying, wait a minute. The media are corporate. They do whatever will get them ratings and make them money, okay? But the truth does remain, 95% of talk radio is right-wing conservative. And in many parts of the country, there is no other side.
Yeah.
You hear one point of view over and over. Republicans and the country at large have been primed to believe certain things over the past 35, 40 years, including the myth of the liberal media. And when you hear the same thing over and over, and you never hear the other side, and particularly when you're now living in a world where you can, in fact, choose your media to avoid hearing the other side, you now have a large group of people who are not actives the way you and I are, okay? Mm-hmm. You and I might read a whole bunch of stuff and talk about a whole bunch of stuff, and we analyze it. The vast majority of the folks, it's like, oh, they heard something about that, so therefore it must be true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they saw it on Fox and Friends, so therefore. And they have a very hard time, not because they're stupid, but because nobody has ever really gotten into the art of analysis with them. So they hear a commentator saying X, and they figure that, that must be a news person.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, poor Bret Baier, who is a very good news person, okay? And Shepard Smith and, you know, Chris Wallace. These people are actual journalists. But because they're on Fox News, I have the feeling that what they say and what they do carries no more weight with the Fox News viewers than Hannity or Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
And in fact, Hannity and Tucker Carlson may carry more weight because they say the things that these folks have been taught to believe over the years. Because the Democrats have never really had an organized propaganda channel or an organized talk radio strategy, unfortunately, the Democratic listener or viewer is not primed to use like one official source, okay? So we don't have anything like that on the Democratic side.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, I can listen to Stephanie Miller, I can watch Rachel Maddow, but there has not been an overwhelming strategy of 40 years duration like there has been on the conservative side. They've been very effective at it.
Yeah, in fact, you know, Stephanie Miller, Randy Rhodes, Tom Hartman, they are really exceptions to, by and large, I think, a failure of liberals to create compelling content for broadcast radio. And we saw that with Air America, which did, I mean...
I begged them to let me consult them. I was a very good radio consultant, I promise you. I spent 28 years training people on both sides, okay, righties and lefties. I train talk show hosts to be entertaining, informative, and courteous because I believe you can still do it. Okay? You don't have to be a name-calling bully to be a good talk show host. Okay? And I called up Air America. I offered to consult them for free, and they wouldn't return my calls.
Oh, my God.
So,
Well, that makes sense. I mean, the stories that I've heard about Air America, that makes complete sense that they would be that suicidal.
And there I am with my 28 years in the biz. You know, it's not like I'm a guy in a diner. Okay, it's like I really do know what I'm doing, guys. Hello,
yep.
But nope. my phone wasn't ringing.
No.
So there you are.
It seems like the reason why I believe so many people are okay with Donald Trump behaving the way he behaves is because they have been told by the news media that suddenly, out of nowhere, it's okay if the president acts just like you. It's okay if the president is no smarter than you are, viewer.
And if he expresses grievance 24/7.
Yeah.
Everything is about, we're being wronged, we're being treated badly, we're the victims, and the we that he's talking to really understand that dog whistle. They know who they are, and they sincerely believe that everything has been taken from them. And what they don't understand is that the swamp lives on in Washington. The swamp is prospering. People from overseas have to stay in Trump hotels if they want to get any access. But unfortunately, that part isn't really analyzed. What is analyzed is, look how badly they are treating you. They meaning, you know, Democrats, immigrants, fill in the blank. And unfortunately, it's so easy to get online, spout off, say horrible things, and then if you just keep communicating in that way, that starts to become what you believe and you start acting on it. Now, I'm not saying Democrats are perfect, okay? Last time I checked, I don't have a halo, nor does anybody else.
And besides, I do.
You know, well, other than you. Other than you.
Speak for yourself.
I've voted for Republicans in the past. Yeah. I've voted for independents in the past. I've voted for people based on their issues and based on what I thought they could do for the country.
Sure.
Unfortunately, I don't see this president doing anything for the country. Mm-hmm. What he's doing is for his base and for his businesses.
Yeah.
And I think that's profoundly disappointing. I haven't seen him reach out to the rest of us even once. And while that may make his base feel great because they've been told for 40 years that, like, we're the ones doing all this terrible stuff to them, it's profoundly dangerous for the country to think in that way. Mm-hmm. I'm not the enemy. Mm-hmm. You're not the enemy. Democrats aren't the enemy. The enemy is hatred and bigotry and injustice and income inequality. There is so much that we could be working on, and instead we're distracted with, oh my God, what did he say on Twitter today? And that's part of the game. He knows how to run the news cycle.
You know what? I think we underestimate the efficacy of talk radio in particular. Because,
I've
in fact,
said this for years.
I think talk radio gave rise to Fox News Channel, which gave rise to Donald Trump's style of being president, his leadership style. And so
this all started with the Fairness Doctrine, and I know some people hated the Fairness Doctrine, and I know that my conservative friends believe that the Fairness Doctrine stifled free speech. Trust me, as a media historian, it did not.
Yeah.
There were some great right-wing talk show hosts on the air during the era of the Fairness Doctrine. Mm-hmm. You just had to provide the other side. So you, what a lot of stations did was they had one righty host and then they had a lefty host. And it was kind of interesting because you got to hear both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But when the Fairness Doctrine ended in 1987, which Reagan had promised, once that ended, now it was open season on one-sided radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to the Rush Limbaughs of the world. And I'm not criticizing Rush. He absolutely, and I mean Rush, the talk show host, as opposed to Rush, the band. Rush, the talk show host, really did save AM radio.
Yeah.
There is no denying it. AM radio was on the decline. And he came on and he was bloviating and bombastic and he said rude things. But he was also funny back then.
Mm-hmm.
He was also entertaining. He wasn't as polemical as he became later on.
Yeah.
He was actually kind of interesting to listen to when I wanted to hear what the other side was.
He's a hell of a good broadcaster. I mean, there's no doubt about that. He knows what he's doing when he sits in front of a microphone.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I suggest to you that those techniques are also found in Mr. Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Trump knows what he's doing when he says some outrageous thing because he knows that the media, it's going to be like, squirrel! And everybody's going to just go, like, following the shiny object.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And instead of talking about some of the issues in our culture that haven't been addressed at all we're busy talking about, oh my God, can you believe what he just tweeted?
Yeah.
Well, yes, I can actually, because he's the id. He's reflecting the grievance, the anger, the frustration, the this, the that. But nothing is getting solved. Nothing was delivered. Nothing was received. It's just been 2 years of keeping everybody angry.
Yeah.
Now, how does that help the country, Bob? No. You're a smart guy. You tell me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you can see it on Twitter every damn day, especially this week for some reason. But that's another story. But I always look at this, Donna, from the perspective of the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine being sort of the secular version of, say, for example, repealing the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. The Fairness Doctrine protected the public airwaves, the air that we all share as American citizens. This belongs to all of us. And so, therefore, that air shouldn't be occupied by one political point of view. And that's what it is now. It would be the same way as if they were to somehow to repeal the Establishment Clause of the Constitution and then establish one religion for the entire country.
He dog whistles people about that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the judges that he's putting into place, I don't think our founders wanted a theocracy, okay? And, I mean, historically speaking, they all came from England where they were Christian, but they were the wrong kind of Christian in many cases. And so they decided Congress will make no law respecting an establishment of religion.
That's right.
And as someone from a minority religion, I mean, Jews only make up about 3% of the population here, I'm delighted we've got that clause, because I really don't want anyone to impose their religious beliefs on me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fine about people believing whatever, that you let a thousand flowers bloom, but just let me believe what I believe, and let's not have that be part of the government. Let's have that separation of church and state back.
Yep.
I miss it.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really miss it.
Yeah.
But seriously, the thing that worries me more than anything is the lack of thinking, okay? When Rush were out there doing what they do, they were regarded as a very cerebral band, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there were people that went there just, you know, went to the concerts just to be headbangers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But there were also a lot of people who thought about the lyrics.
Yeah.
And I really feel like there isn't as much thinking lately. There's an awful lot of reacting. There's an awful lot of just spouting off and saying the first thing that comes to your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Social media enables that. It empowers it. So does some of the talk radio that's out there. So does some of the, you know, news channels, including Sinclair. It's not just Fox.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we're not living in a culture where education is respected.
Mm.
Look at this scandal with, you know, I want to get my kid into a good school, even if she's been on Twitter saying she hates school and she doesn't even want to go. But because she's rich, I'm going to make sure she goes.
That's right.
And I'm sitting there like, why are you all entitled to everything? No one's entitled to anything. We're all just living on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And the manipulation, the domination, and the worship of money. I mean, I'm going to quote the New Testament for a second. Oh, my God, you're Jewish. You're quoting the New Testament. Hey, I'll quote whatever.
Sure.
But Paul, I believe it was St. Paul who said that the love of money is the root of all evil. He didn't say money was the root of all evil. Money is just, it is what it is. You can
mm-hmm.
use it for charity. You can use it to do good in the world. But it's the love of money that's the root of all evil.
Yep.
And the moment you start putting money ahead of anything else, I mean, Rush sang about that, the big money,
mm-hmm.
big money ain't got no soul.
Yeah.
It doesn't. It doesn't.
Well, and one
and
of
this
the,
is where we are.
One of the most groundbreaking periods of time for the band itself with regard to their career and indeed building their career and making more and more money was this decision they made after Caress of Steel to say, you know what, to hell with everything, we're going to make the album that we want to make. Now, they could have made
Absolutely.
Something like, you know, Badfinger or Steve Miller Band or something like that. They could have done what the label wanted them to do, and they could have made quite a bit of money doing that. If they had reconfigured, maybe brought in a different singer or something like that, done what the record label wanted them to do. And instead, they put out this album, 2112, which was Absolutely. Just a big FU to all of it.
Absolutely.
And indeed, it ended up, you know, fortune favors the bold. It ended up changing their entire trajectory for the better, because that earned them the ability to then go on to do all kinds of albums that they wanted to do rather than what the record label wanted them to
do. Right, and you hear this kind of talked about in Spirit of Radio, mm-hmm. you know, glittering prizes and endless compromises shatter the illusion of integrity. This is what they wanted to do. They never wanted to lose their integrity, okay? They love radio. They wanted to be on radio, but they weren't willing to sell out to do it.
Yeah. Well, the great irony is that radio, you, broke Rush, yet radio kind of abandoned Rush, didn't it?
Well, radio did not embrace Rush right away, okay? In fact, this is always hilarious to me. After you've become reasonably famous, suddenly all the hangers-on come out like, oh, you know, I always liked you, you know? There's a line in John Lennon, The Ballad of John and Yoko, you know, the men from the press said, we wish you to success. It's great to have the both of you back.
You right, know? You know what
and
I think of?
People had vilified them, you know?
Yeah, you know who I think of when I think of that, Donna, is Jan Wenner from Rolling Stone.
Oh,
I mean, you know what I mean?
One of the most hilarious moments of my life was being at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, and the moment he came out on stage, everyone started booing him. It was hilarious. We booed him for a full 5 minutes.
Wow.
He finally just kind of, it never made the tape, I'm
of
sure,
course,
that when
yeah.
the HBO, you know. But I was there, and he finally said, okay, I get it. I get it. And we were like, yeah, we hope you do, pal.
I tell you what, that moment when he said, and from Toronto, and and everyone, including you, just went nuts with a standing ovation that must have, it seemed like it lasted 15 minutes if it lasted a minute.
Absolutely, but first we booed him. Yeah. But that's the bottom line, though. Mm-hmm. When I first discovered Rush, and I cannot for the life of me understand why some people on social media want to tell me that, no, I didn't.
That's ridiculous.
The band thinks I did. Hello?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, then, of course, there's the qualifier, which is you brought Rush to America, and that's all I meant. Yes.
I have never tried to aggrandize myself based on what I did for Rush.
Right.
I have been more than clear. You can play back other interviews I have done.
Yeah, it's undisputed.
I have said multitudinous times what I did was what a music director was supposed to do. I was doing my job. I did not have a blinding vision from heaven where it was like, you know, and 40 years from now, you'll be at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I was like, what? I got this record from Bob Roper of A&M of Canada, who in an altruistic gesture sent it down to me, even though his label had passed on it, because he just thought it had something to it, and I had a lot of friends in the Canadian music industry, and I played a lot of Canadian music, and he sent it down to me, and I played it, and I dropped the needle on Working Man, and it is a total myth that I had to use the restroom. That is utter nonsense. Long songs were jokingly called bathroom songs.
Bathroom songs, of
because
course.
When nature called, you had to have a lot. It was live radio, you know. You weren't going to just say to the audience, excuse me, nature is calling. So what you did was you put on a long song. Yeah. But they had to be good long songs or nobody would play them.
That's right.
So I was looking for a good long song.
Yeah.
And I had no idea at the time. I would be lying if I said otherwise. I had no idea that I'd end up friends with the band. Mm. I had no idea that we would be keeping in touch 40 plus years later. I had no idea that I'd make all the friends that I made as a result of my work, you know, getting Rush airplay in the States. When I say I discovered Rush, all I mean is I helped to launch their career in the United States.
Yeah.
And at the time, I had no idea what it would lead to. It was just, I believed in this band. I was going to fight for this band. I was going to help them in any way I could, whether it was like recommending them to a U.S. record label or recommending them to a management company in the States. They had management in Canada, but you need agents everywhere. I mean, these were the things. I called other stations and told them they ought to play Rush, that kind of thing. But I did it at the time just because I believed in the band, never realizing that it would lead to anything.
I mean, how could you?
And I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, and how could you foresee at that point in time where Rush was even going to go?
I mean, couldn't, because you and I both know. We've both been in radio.
Yeah.
There have been a million songs that you and I have listened to over the years, and we were like, wow, piece of crap. And the thing went to number one.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other songs that you and I both listened to. It was, oh, my God, this song is amazing.
There's
and it died like a dog.
No predicting. No predicting how that works.
There's no, I mean, I personally, I cannot stand, for example, some of the boy bands. No offense, okay? I mean, I never liked New Kids on the Block, this and that. But I certainly understand how they became famous, and I certainly understand that for some people, that's their favorite song. Mm-hmm. So I know that not everybody likes Rush, and it's an acquired taste, and et cetera, but I also knew that it was a perfect record for Cleveland.
Yeah.
And when I got to meet the band and found what nice people they were, family men, decent human beings, it just made me feel all the more like, wow, I'm really glad I did something to try to help these guys.
Right.
And it turned out to be a friendship that I've had for, oh my God, more than 40 years.
Right.
How lucky am I?
So this,
but I had no way of knowing that, and I'm glad it turned out the way it did.
Sure. And this began at WMMS in Cleveland, Ohio. And
it led to my being on your podcast. I mean,
exactly.
Sir, I repeat, how lucky am I?
And that was that was 1974, right? Is that right?
That is correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. I walked away from tenure in the Boston Public Schools to follow my heart and go into broadcasting. I had been fighting for a job in broadcasting for years, and nobody would hire me because I was female. And back then, they still were not hiring a lot of women for anything other than traditional stuff. And rock and roll radio was finally starting to hire some women.
Yeah.
And by the grace of God or whoever else, I was able to have a long career in broadcasting. But yeah, the first place I ended up going after being on the air at a small daytime station in Greater Boston, I ended up at WMMS in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up there at a very strange time.
Yeah.
Very strange time.
Well, it was a strange time in radio overall, and specifically FM radio. I've talked to a lot of guys, and, you know, and in fact, I read Jim Ladd's book, Radio Waves, which is an amazing document to describe and illustrate what the 70s were like with FM rock radio.
Absolutely.
And
my whole problem
was
I got in it for the music, not for the lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, as anybody knows me will tell you, I mean, I don't smoke, I don't drink, and I don't do drugs. And I could tell you many hilarious stories of record promoters who came to the station expecting that, like, oh, the new music director, let's give her a nickel bag, you know, or perhaps a dime bag. And I'm standing there looking at them like, what is this and why do I want it? You know? And no, it's good stuff. It's really good stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't do drugs.
If you
and, of course, being a record promoter, they turn on a dime and thought, you know what? Neither do I. You know, I don't use them either. I'm so glad you said that. You know?
Somehow broadcasting always attracts the people with substance abuse issues.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Oh, God. Well, later in the decade, they were having AA meetings and, you know, this and that at conventions. You would go to a convention and you would see that they had a room for Friends of Bill W., which was code for AA. You know, Bill Wilson, one of the founders of AA. So people were starting to get into recovery. But at the time that I was at MMS, there was just an awful lot of that stuff going on.
Oh, sure.
And when they found out that I wasn't a hippie chick, that was a real problem, and I didn't get along with a lot of the people at the station. Interestingly enough, discovering Rush became my ticket for getting more acceptance because WMMS was famous for breaking bands.
Yeah.
And as a music director, it was fun to be part of that. But once Rush really took off for our audience, suddenly, oh my God, I was like the best person ever.
Yeah, you know,
even though I didn't do all this stuff. So,
well,
and what's funny is the guys in the band never cared that I didn't do all that stuff. They
sure.
were fine about it.
Oh, yeah. And I've heard all the stories. Like, I think Gene Simmons talks about how, you know, they were, Kiss was off partying and having sex with anything that moved. And the guys
and
from
Getty
Rush
was like, I got to call my girlfriend.
Yeah, the guys are just reading a book. They were reading, like, Neil was sitting in the corner reading Tolkien or something.
you know what I mean?
It's just,
and,
I love
Getty,
that image.
Getty and his wife are like the love story of all time. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's for real. That thing in the movie where it's like, where Gene Simmons is like, oh, we tried to get him a groupie, and he was like, oh, I got to call my fiance. There you go. I mean, the two of them, God bless them. They got two lovely kids who are both grown now. But I'm saying, these really are family men. What you see is what you get. You may not like their music, but they are totally consistent. They are not hypocrites. They were as untouched by fame. When you saw the two of them, like, sitting in that donut shop, what was it, Tim Hortons and Beyond the Lighted Stage, and that just, like, people come up to them like,
scene.
Aren't you Getty? No, he is. I'm not.
Yeah. See, that's the thing, Donna, and this is what I try to tell anyone who asks me about Rush. What do you love about Rush? And first of all, I say that I am genuinely in love with their music, but I'm not just in love with their music. I'm in love with their personalities and their work ethic. I mean, the overall vibe of the band is more than just the music. It sounds weird to say as a 47-year-old grown-up, but I always considered the guys in Rush to be role models, especially Neil, who, ironically, I know more about Neil's personal life than anyone else in the band, based on his writing and so on, his books. But they're the kinds of people that I just find to be utterly satisfying to read about, because the way they approach their work and the way they approach their hobbies and their life, it's I don't know how to necessarily describe it other than to say they're very precise. Obviously they're celebrities, but they seem like
they don't act like celebrities.
I was just going to say,
okay, they're the kind of guys that you really could go to a diner with them. Okay,
yeah.
I mean, yes, a million people would want their autographs, but I'm saying in theory, they are completely untouched by fame. Okay,
right.
They don't walk around like, don't you know who I am? Okay, and you and I have met people, whether in politics or whether in the music industry, who are just like, they've been reading too many of their own press reviews, like they really do think it's about them, and it's not.
Yeah.
Okay, like I said at the beginning, none of us get anything coming, okay? We're all just lucky to be here, and we all have good days and bad days. And here are guys who have, their music has been life-changing, whether you like them, whether you hate them. Their music has changed lives worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, they're just the same down-to-earth people that they were, like, back when I first met them in 1974.
Yeah. Well, there's
how many people can you say that?
Well, I think that there's a relationship between listeners, enthusiasts of Rush, and the guys in the band themselves, where I think we all, and in fact, this was in Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie about Queen, where they were talking about how that Queen in particular, but this also applies to Rush, is kind of a place where all of us misfits and outcasts can get together and not necessarily be judged. We're all the same. I was that kid from the Subdivisions video. I mean, and that was entirely me. And when I saw that video, it spoke to me in a way that I felt like, wow, this is a place, this music and the members of the band seem to be my people. They're from my planet. I kind of think of it in terms of that.
It.
You know what I mean?
No, I totally get it. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why I became a DJ.
Mm-hmm.
I was a very lonely kid. I didn't have a lot of friends. There were a lot of people out there who really mocked me. There was a lot of anti-Semitism in the culture, et cetera. And radio and music were my escape.
Yeah.
DJs were kind of like friends to me. And so I said to myself, if I could do that, That would be such a great gift. And to be able to get on the radio and break a new band like Rush, to be able to play Working Man and have people resonate with it so much, and then to play the other records and over the years watch them grow and watch them improve and watch them go off in some tangents that I wish they hadn't gone off on, and watch them, like, by their own admission, kind of just rein themselves back in and get back to doing the things that they did best. But in all of it, they never really changed.
Yes.
They were the same decent human beings. And that's what I'm left with more than anything. This is what I miss. I miss decency. We were talking about politics, okay? There should come a point where you think about what is the decent, ethical, honorable thing to do. I wish there were more of that. Instead of the anger, the grievance, and the rage tweeting, I wish there were more like, how can we all get together and fix some of what's broken? Because we helped to break it. So, you know, if the people at the top ain't going to fix it, I guess it's going to fall to us.
Yeah, there's a level of discipline about Rush that I think is so inspiring. And it's not only in terms of their consistency and continuity throughout the years, throughout the decades, to continue to make great music, to continue to progress as musicians.
More than four decades, absolutely. And their music has stood the test of time.
Yeah.
But they really, they wanted people to think. It's what we were talking about before. It wasn't just, you know, I lost my baby, bop, op, shabop, doo-wah. You know? I mean, yeah, they tried to do a couple of mass appeal records. Yes, they did. But by and large, they really are a thinking person's band. And they wanted their fans to do more than just react. You know, it's nice that you think the music's great. Now think about the lyrics. Think about what we're saying. Think about what we want you to do out there to make the world better. If people knew the number of dollars in charitable contributions this band has made, including Neil, for all of his talk about, like, you know, libertarian this and libertarian that, in his private life, a very charitable person. And the same with the other two guys. But again, they didn't want the glory. They didn't want to be on the cover of Time magazine for all of their charity. They just wanted to do the right thing. And sometimes that's what it just comes down to.
Do you think Neil's addition to the band way back in basically the same year in which you discovered Rush, do you think Neil's influence on Geddy and Alex changed their trajectory in terms of where they may have been headed, not only career-wise, but as people, as musicians?
Yes and no.
As family
yes
men.
And no. Yes and no, and I'll tell you why. When they did the first album, they did it largely because they thought they had to be a three-chord rock and roll band that got on the radio.
Right.
John Rutsey was already having health problems. It is, of course, a scurrilous myth that he was a drug addict. He was not. He had diabetes, and he was a kid, and he wasn't taking care of himself. And back in those days, it was much more difficult to maintain your health if you had diabetes. Okay? So the band already sort of knew that they were probably going to need a new drummer. They also knew the three-chord rock and roll bar band scene in Toronto was pretty packed, okay? There already were a lot of them, and they weren't getting the radio airplay they were hoping for. And Geddy and Alex instinctively knew that it was time for the next thing. And when they auditioned drummers, one of the things they were looking for was someone who could help take the band to the next level. That was a very important thing for them, and it was something they already wanted. So I think to some degree, Neil brought out the best in the other two guys, but they already, they were ready. Okay, it's kind of like you try to quit smoking, you try and you try and you try, and then one day you're just, you're ready. Okay? And you sit there going, wow, why didn't I do this sooner?
Well, exactly.
Because you weren't ready is why, but you're ready now. So I think that deep down inside, the guys knew that it was time for the next thing, whatever that looked like. And when Neil came along, they were ready. And they embraced it. Okay? At first, Geddy was a little intimidated by Neil, just because of the fact that he knew a lot of poetry and a lot of this and a lot of philosophy and blah, blah, blah. But they really respected each other. Mm-hmm. They really brought out the best in each other. Yeah. And it just became like he was the new guy, you know, and they became this seamless unit. Mm-hmm. The person I've always kind of felt bad for is Rutsy, because maybe he would have ended up getting replaced anyhow.
Yeah.
But had this been modern times, like had he had diabetes today, oh my God, you do your little finger stick thing and then you go back out to work.
That's right.
So back then it was like you went to the hospital and you needed to be an infusion and this and that. And he was 18. He wasn't going to do that.
Right.
So today he would have a much easier time managing his illness, mm-hmm. and he might actually have caught on with another band.
Yeah.
But unfortunately back then there was no other plan. He ended up very ill. He ended up, I think he was blind at the end.
Oh, man.
And yeah, it was just brutal.
Yeah.
And I think about that because, like, I'm a cancer survivor. I've been cancer-free now by the grace of God and by the grace of my doctors mm-hmm. for 4 years.
Oh, congratulations.
The kind of cancer, thank you. The kind of cancer that I have, my grandmother died of, and she was only 44. My point is, had she lived today, she'd still be around, and I might have gotten to meet her. I never did get to meet her. So when I look at something like the John Rutsy story, I look at, wow, born too soon, born in the wrong time.
Yeah.
He could have been a rock and roll drummer with some other band that just wanted to do, like, no offense, three-chord rock and roll. There's a place for it, okay? He could have been a really good drummer somewhere, because I cannot criticize some of the stuff on that first album. I know a lot of people are like, oh, it's so primitive compared to, you know, 2112. But yeah, except there wouldn't be 2112
right.
if it weren't for that first album,
yep.
okay? That's what put them on the path. It had moments of brilliance in it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Finding My Way is a great song. I still get the chills when I hear it. Here Again is an interesting song, okay? And of course, Working Man. Working Man aged so well that they were still playing it on their, you know, R40 tour,
oh, yeah.
for heaven's sake.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, I feel bad for John Rutsy, who has been just about totally forgotten. And I always wonder, what would he have become if he had had the opportunity health-wise?
Yeah.
But in the meantime, I'm glad that Rush were able to continue to grow and change. And Neil was part of that, but it was a part that they wanted.
Well, I mean, I can completely understand that dynamic when Neil entered the band and the trajectory of the band changed as a mutual thing. But he was a huge catalyst for that. But the reason I say that is that he's just so impressive, not just as the greatest rock drummer, that's a given, but as a writer, philosopher, and as I said before, as a positive role model for being
absolutely
a professional, someone who has a zeal for life. And, you know,
yes.
his philosophy of what is the most excellent thing I can do today. In fact, he inspired me, and you mentioned smoking actually a couple of times today. He inspired me to take up bike riding because of Masked Rider, which is his first book.
Yep.
And that, it can be argued, saved my life because it forced me to quit smoking after 17 years. I smoked a good all the way up until 2007. And the three of them together as a working unit for 40 years is kind of lightning in a bottle, don't you think?
Absolutely.
I mean, and I think a lot of that had to do with Neil bringing to the table this process of working, I think, that, of course, Alex and Geddy both adapted and adopted themselves, and they worked together as a unit. But I think it was Neil's influence along those lines that provided longevity that maybe they wouldn't have otherwise had. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, and I can't disagree with it. My interpretation, just from being friendly with the band,
sure, you would know more than me.
My interpretation is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I totally understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I think that each of the band members brought their own unique strength, okay? And, like, they are three really ethical human beings.
Yes.
And you rarely find that, okay? I thought it was interesting in the Beyond the Lighted Stage documentary where Geddy was asked, you know, like, have you gotten any, like, audition tapes from other drummers? Because Neil was off being depressed about what had happened to him and everything
right.
like that. I mean, losing your wife and losing your daughter, I mean, wow,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And I understand completely. And yet, remember what Geddy said? He said, if there's no Neil, There's no bad. Rush.
Right.
And even though today they're, you know, Getty and Alex would like to collaborate on some things. Contrary to internet myth, it's not happening this week, and, you know, there's not going to be a new Rush. But that's the point. There won't be a new Rush.
Right.
Because Getty and Alex do not want to replace Neil. This is a band that had so much admiration and respect for each other. It's a very unusual thing. I mean, you and I have both been around rock and roll for years, okay? Mm-hmm. And you know, and I know, in most bands, somebody dies, they just, like, bury him, and they're back out on the road with the replacement.
Right.
Okay?
Exactly.
It's like the guy wasn't even cold in the ground, and they've already got him replaced, okay? But in the case of Rush, they were willing to wait as long as it took for Neil to come back. And to this day, they could have, because Getty would still like to do some more music, and so would Alex. They're still friends. They still, by the way, it's a complete myth that they don't talk to Neil and they're mad at him. Utter nonsense. Where some of this stuff comes from online just irritates
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I know.
They talk to each other on a regular basis.
Of course.
But the fact remains, they're not going to recreate Rush with some other drummer. There is no other drummer. There is no other Rush. These are people who admire each other, who respect each other, and whatever the next thing is for each of them, they will do it in the same ethical, honorable, respectful way they always have.
Yeah.
And that is so unusual in the music industry.
Oh, yeah, especially now, Donna, because it's amazing. They're also disciplined in their retirement, which is so strange to see, because today we're dealing with a music industry where the touring actually leads the albums, where it used to be the reverse of that. You would tour to support the album, but it's vice versa now. And you see a lot of bands, especially that came up in the 70s, doing kind of nostalgia versions of legacy versions.
That's something Neil said to me one time. He was like, I don't want to be a parody.
Yeah.
I don't want to have people say, like, oh my God, they should have retired. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, you see some of these bands out there, they can't hit the notes anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sitting there going, oh my God, why are they still out there?
Mm-hmm.
And Rush never wanted to be that band.
Yeah.
When the time came, and I know it broke the hearts of many of us, but when the time came, you know, it comes for all of us, and it's a wise person that knows when it's time for the next thing.
Yeah.
And Neil had such tendonitis. He was in such pain. And when he looked at it and when he talked it over with his family, it became a much easier decision. And now he's fine about it. He's on to the next thing. That's not what the fans want to hear. But I always say to them, would you rather that he was in constant pain and he couldn't even hug his kid? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, no.
You know?
Yeah.
It's over. And if he were to be out there not at his best, that would never have worked for him. He never wanted to be, you know, his best to us. It's like, oh, you know, like, well, it's fine the way it is, but not to Neil.
Mm-hmm.
Neil knew the level he wanted to play at.
Yeah.
And when he felt he couldn't do it anymore, he felt it was time to get off the stage.
Mm-hmm. As heartbreaking as it was to see them retire from, at least from tour, because I know Alex and Getty, from what they've said in interviews, are planning to maybe do something in the not-too-distant future without Neil as a separate project. But, I mean, when they announced the overall retirement of Rush, it was devastating. But at the same time, it would have been far more devastating to see Rush, to see these three guys up there 10 years from now doing some sort of legacy version of the band with maybe side performers and just not being able to play at the same level of ferocity and hit the same notes and be able to do what they've always done.
They wanted to go out on a high note.
Yeah.
I think the R40 tour was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I know it didn't hit all the cities that they wanted it to. Part of that was booking issues, because if you can't get a venue, you can't get a venue. Part of it was Neil. Part of it was just life in the big city. They did the best they could do. They went to as many cities as they could, and they went out on a high note.
Yeah.
They really did. When I was with Alex, when they came to Boston and I was backstage with him, and I blogged about this. I said, you know, like, I'm not generally speechless, But in this particular case, the words just got in the way. I just like hugged him for a long time because we both knew this was probably it.
Yeah.
This was probably the last tour. And I have so many good memories of the people I met on tour, you know, meeting them in different cities when the band was playing, so many people that I'm still friendly with, and they have left a lasting legacy.
Yeah.
And I wish there were more of that in the culture. That's what I was trying to say at the beginning, as everybody got probably very upset that we were talking politics. But I just, you know, I just wish that their legacy could be getting people back to thinking again, getting people back to analyzing before they react, and getting people to be more understanding of different points of view. You don't have to agree with someone to respect them.
Yeah.
Why is all I'm saying.
Why do you think, Donna, and I imagine you would have some unique insight into this, why do you think Rush has been mainly considered a guy band?
Well, it's interesting because when you go to their concerts, you do see a lot of women. And there are a lot of women who are Rush fans. But I think in general, hard rock has been gendered for years as something that only guys like and that women supposedly want these, like, touching lyrics. Hey, I like touching lyrics. Some of the lyrics in some of the Rush songs are touching. The Garden is a great song.
Oh, my God,
okay,
yes.
I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah.
Entre Nous, okay? I mean, there are some amazing songs that the guys have done. And the myth that only men like Rush or that only men like hard rock, I think is profoundly misguided. But then again, there's so many things in the culture that women are not supposed to like. I mean, I'm working on a journal article right now. I do a lot of freelance writing. I'm doing a journal article about women and baseball. And for years, women were told that, like, well, you know, you can't possibly understand baseball. I mean, it's just so complicated, you know.
Jeez.
And you couldn't possibly be a sports writer because, like, you wouldn't be able to. And if you're at the ballpark, well, you're probably there because your boyfriend dragged you there. I've been going to ball games since I was 10 years old. Nobody dragged. I dragged my father. I was like, you know, you got to take me to a ball game.
Yeah.
I really want to go. And I've always loved sports. Okay. From the time I was a kid, I loved, I don't know where I got it from. I have the feeling that if you talk to female Rush fans, they really get tired of having to explain that they're female Rush fans.
Yeah.
But I just, over the years, I've seen an increased number of women and girls at the concerts because I saw an increased number of families. People apprentice their kids into a love of Rush. Okay.
Yeah.
You have Rush families. You got like the daddy that likes it, who tells the kids and the kids tell their friends and everybody tells everybody else's friends. And it's this giant extended family. When I was going to concerts for our 40, I was really gratified to see how many women and kids were at those concerts, and the kids knew the songs because they had been apprenticed into it. But yeah, at the beginning, you're right. It probably was gendered like, well, women don't like hard rock.
Yeah.
There may be some truth to that, but I've always thought that was just another myth because I've known a number of women who did, in fact, like hard rock. And vice versa, I've also known some men who like singer-songwriters and folk music. And come on, it's all music. If it speaks to you, terrific.
That's
Let
right.
it speak to you.
Yeah. You know, let's talk about 80s Rush, because obviously there's a lot of controversy that surrounds that that period of time for the band. I've always gravitated to their more synth-oriented work, mainly because it's I always thought it was ballsy for them to go in that direction. And it's also obviously and clearly well-crafted. The other thing is I don't have any sort of music bigotry against synthesizers. As long as there's a human being playing them, what difference does it make? Why do you think fans saw that era as a betrayal? It seems like the logical evolution of the band. That was the next step that they could logically take going out of
movie
pictures.
Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
Can I tell you something? I don't think fans saw it as a betrayal.
Ah.
Okay? I think that the truth is we're all accustomed to the noisiest voices speaking for everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know anything about social media, the people that are rage tweeting the most may not represent the mass audience.
Right.
Okay? The average person, they're just getting up and going to work, and they don't have time to be sending 6,000 tweets.
Yeah, it's, really like, it's like in radio where there's a difference between the number of listeners and the number of callers. You know what I mean?
Right. There's something, there's a difference between actives and passives.
Right.
Actives are listeners who just, they know every song, every lyric, every DJ. They're going to call you up and tell you, well, you said it was from 1991, and it was actually from 1992. So, you know, yeah. That's your typical active, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority, they make up a very noisy 7 to 10% of the audience, okay?
Yeah.
And it's very easy to think that because they're so noisy, that they represent the mass audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I have the feeling that some of the actives that are Rush fans, they're the ones that got on the chat groups. They're the ones that, you know, called the stations that were playing Rush. They're the ones that, you know, complained loudly about, like, well, what is this with moving pictures and all this, you know, can't stand Tom Sawyer,
wow.
You know, limelight's too soft, blah, blah, blah. And the reality is the average person was like, wow, I really like Limelight. I like the lyrics,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
And YYZ, what a great song, you know? And Red Barchetta, I mean, come on, you know? So I think we have to be very careful in assessing what the public wanted, because those records really sold well.
Yeah.
So if everybody was against them, who bought them?
Exactly right. You know, if the label had forced them to be more popular oriented, and of course I go to albums like Power Windows and Hold Your Fire, which I love those albums. I don't know about anyone else, but I mean, I think those are great albums that I tend to gravitate towards more than some of the others. But
I'm a big fan of Permanent Waves. I love Moving
yeah.
Pictures. I mean, come on.
Well, I mean, this was a decision by the band to go in that
yes,
direction.
Absolutely.
And if you trust their tastes, then this is something that you almost have to accept rather than it being foisted upon them by
absolutely.
Radio
but
airplay
here again,
or something
you know,
like that.
This is, you know, glittering prizes and endless compromises.
Yep.
These are people who have integrity. They're going to make the kind of music they make. But honest to God, the vast majority of the fans, they were real happy with whatever direction Rush were going in.
Yeah.
Yes, there were a few people that were cranky. You know, social media empowered that. They were able to get online and complain about that like they complain about everything else. But that's fine. That's what they do.
Yeah.
The vast majority of us, we're like, wow, a new Rush album just came out. That's cool. Let's see what's on it, you know?
Right, right.
And, yeah, I like some songs better than others. Of course I do. I mean, it's like eating at a restaurant. Some dishes are great. Some dishes, you know, I think, meh, you know? But that doesn't mean, well, I'll never go here again.
Right.
It just means you know what to order. As a DJ, my job was to pick out the best songs for people. And I always got good reactions from those 80s Rush albums. In fact, some people thought they were more accessible.
Interesting.
So I failed to see who those mythical people were that felt the band was betraying its... It wasn't betraying a thing. They were just going in the direction they were going, God bless them.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that they did.
Well, and if it hadn't been for Hold Your Fire, we wouldn't have had Presto, and then we wouldn't have had Roll the Bones, and then Counterparts.
That, but it's back to what I said earlier about that first album. Oh my God, that's so primitive. No, that's so necessary.
Yeah.
Okay? Because it helped them to lay the foundation that became what we have today.
Yeah, exactly
and,
right.
And I'm so glad to be a part of that. And you know what else I'm so glad about? I have wanted to be on your podcast since almost forever. And if it weren't for the fact that I was involved with Rush's career, you and I might never have had a conversation.
Yeah.
So I feel profoundly grateful
that
because of that, it led me to you. And it led me to so many other really wonderful people.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot complain about that, okay? I mean, I understand that not everybody likes Rush. Okay, fine. But there sure has been a large number of interesting people from all over the world who are fans. I've got to go to conferences, conventions, you know, the Hollywood Walk of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm just your basic working class kid. I feel so fortunate at the people that I've been able to meet thanks to knowing Rush. And it just, it's something that till the day I die, I will always be profoundly grateful.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, I'm grateful to you. I mean, to have the Mutual Admiration Society here. Had it not been for you discovering the band, I wouldn't have this this amazing body of work, all of this great music that I've listened to throughout my teen years into being an adult, every stage of my life, no matter what's going on. I always know that either on my CD player or in my iTunes, I've got every Rush album waiting for me that I can go back and, like a warm blanket, I can just bathe in this
incredible
music.
And when things are just getting really frustrating, when you're just confronting all of these people that you just want to take them collectively and shake them and say, can't you see? You know, if you're having a bad day, there's nothing like listening to your favorite music to calm you down and to ground you.
Yeah.
It's like that for me. Right. I have certain songs that it's just when I listen to them, it's like, yeah, that. Okay. Do you ever feel that way? Just like, yeah, that. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Why? I mean, I wish I could have said that. I'm a professional writer, but boy, howdy, I wish I could have said that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Absolutely.
I have such admiration for good lyrics. I've always been a good lyrics person. And I just, there are sometimes when you just get so frustrated, and at those times it's nice, like you said, it's like a warm blanket. It's nice to retreat into the music, and it really does help to center you and make you feel better. So thank God for that.
Yeah, and you know, I'd like to have a second discussion sometime for real diehards alone, Donna. Because I mean, obviously we're presenting kind of an overview of the band for a lot of people who are listening to this interview right now, maybe have never heard Rush before. And so one of the things I always like to recommend with first timers is to go and watch two things on YouTube. And these are two very specific things, and I'm sure you have some special insight into both. Obviously, there is a song that they wrote. It's basically the last song in the entire repertoire of the band Rush is The Garden on Clockwork Angels.
I've mentioned it earlier. My favorite songs ever.
It makes me, every time I hear it, not only do I get goosebumps, but I get a little choked up. It is such a beautiful song.
You're a guy. Yeah. You're not supposed to like that. Come on.
That's right.
That's like not a guy song. What's wrong with you? You're going to have to like give up your guy membership, okay?
Yeah.
I want your card back.
I mean, go to YouTube and watch the live video of The Garden. And then after that, to get a sense of what we're talking about when it comes to Neil, Getty, and Alex as men, watch the video of them having dinner for Neil Peart's birthday. And it's just this extended video of basically a lot of Alex just riffing and joking, and they're eating dinner and they're drinking wine and laughing and having a nice time and cracking each other up. To me, there is no greater illustration of those three men as people than that particular video. And I always like to recommend that to, you know, people who are trying to adapt to Rush for
absolutely.
The first time. You know what I mean?
The treasure of a life is a measure of love and respect.
Yep, absolutely.
The way you live, the gifts that you give in the fullness of time, it's the only return that you expect.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was just so unbelievable.
Donna,
it's such a pleasure to talk to you finally, and I can't believe we're out of time already, but we're going to have to wrap up here. But we will do this again in the not-too-distant future, because
Well, I feel privileged.
Yeah, well, so do I. You know, there's so many things that happen in social media and in the entire universe of the internet that are just so strange and just.
Oh, I know. Hey, did you know that Brett Baier of Fox News is a Rush fan?
Is he really?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yes,
yeah.
He is.
And so is John Roberts, in fact, from Fox News.
Absolutely. But this is again what I was saying before about how this band brings people together. And if I had any wish for anybody at any time right now, it would be that we could find more of those common threads, because I know we've got them. I know we do. And beyond the anger, beyond the rage, beyond the partisanship, I wish we could just do what you and I were doing today, which is just kind of riffing on what needs to happen, having fun with it, talking about it in a way that makes a difference, but that doesn't demonize anyone.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's something Rush never did. Rush never mocked people. Mm-hmm. They never did.
Yeah.
They were, they had strong feelings. They had strong emotions, but I can never recall, and Lord knows I've been with them and talked with them. Not like I'm so swell, but I mean, you know, when you're friendly with people, you hang out and you talk with them.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, over the years, I can honestly say, I never heard them mock anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I've had political conversations with Alex, still never heard him mock anybody. I mean, he had very strong views about an issue. We talked about that issue, but it was always issue oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that is so commendable because, again, this is part of the ethics of who these guys are. So
right.
Thank you for the opportunity. I hope I was okay. Did I make any sense? Was I like halfway intelligent?
Of course you made sense. Yes, absolutely.
But I've never been on your podcast. I'm like totally new to this.
Well, you never know.
Not to podcasting, but to your podcast. I've never been on it. Whenever I'm a guest on someone's show, I'm always thinking like, am I doing all right here?
Oh, yeah, you'd be great. If you started a podcast, you'd have thousands and thousands and thousands of listeners. I'm completely
and then I get
convinced.
Lots of rage tweets. I can't believe you said blah blah blah. That's why I did I ever tell you? I know you don't have time, but you probably know why Alex did the blah 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 thing.
Oh yeah, well tell me again. I know, but I don't think anyone else does.
Oh, tell us what you know. What do you know?
Well, I know that originally he had a speech composed, and it was on the
that
prompter.
That is correct.
And
that is correct.
He just felt like after Neil and Getty spoke that he was just going to start out by saying blah blah blah, but then it ended up turning into a blah 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 interpretation of his entire acceptance speech. Is that right?
It was a little more to it than that.
Okay,
and
let's hear the
again.
Rest.
This probably didn't make the cut when HBO did the the 1 hour whatever, just like us booing Jan Wenner for 5 minutes didn't make the cut. Quincy Jones. Okay, everybody got to all the acceptances, the acceptance mm-hmm. speech. I'd like to thank my mother. I'd like to thank my father. I'd like to thank the Academy. And then you take your award and you sit down. And then there was Quincy Jones.
Yeah.
And God bless him. He started off with, I produced such and such a record in 1968. And then I produced this in 1969. And then all of us are looking at each other like, is there a hook? Like, remember the old vaudeville thing where you just take the hook and you just like get the person? Like the guy is like, I'm getting much older, okay? I mean, I could raise a family waiting for him to get finished discussing everything he ever did in his entire career. And it was a very long career. And he must have gone on easily 15 minutes. And people are sitting there like, make it stop, Mommy. Please make it stop, okay? And I have the feeling that inspired Alex to just riff on it, okay?
Wow.
Because it was the longest acceptance speech in the history of humanity. People graduated from college waiting for Quincy Jones to finish his acceptance speech,
that's right.
Okay? I mean, seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't begrudge the guy his great career, but that wasn't the time to get into the conversation about it, okay?
Yeah.
Just like, thank you for this great award and sit. And I really think that inspired Alex to just like, oh my God, I can't believe we're sitting through this.
Yeah, I mean, it was so, you know what it was? It was a rock and roll thing to do, to just say, fuck you, I'm going to do blah, blah, blah for the next 90 seconds.
Yep.
Yeah, amazing.
Can we drop the F-bomb on your podcast? We can do that?
Yeah, oh God, yes. Yeah, this isn't broadcast.
Okay, see, I never would.
Okay.
I never would.
All right. Well, that's good. Good.
I've talked about this with other people. It's kind of like I represent my university, whether I like it or whether I hate it. The fact is,
right.
I represent my university,
mm-hmm.
and I want to talk about the issues. I want to be passionate. But in general, in public, I try really hard to just be courteous. And I'm not saying you weren't. I'm just saying my way of being is always to just kind of not say that stuff. I mean,
sure.
Yes, I do say it at other times, but probably not on a podcast as wonderful as yours, sir.
Well, I always tell the story, Donna, and I'll leave you with this. When I was, it was 1990. I was in college. It was after my first year of college. I was working at a Domino's Pizza delivering pizzas. And I remember my manager turning to me and said, "You know, Bob, you'd make a great manager of a Domino's." And I said, "Oh, yeah?" And he said, "Except for the fact that you say fuck too much." And so there I go. I couldn't be the manager of Domino's because I say the F word too much.
See how you missed your calling.
Damn it. Damn it, me and my foul mouth.
I know. And see, I was told that I couldn't be anything in life because I was female. And then I was told I couldn't be anything in life because I didn't take drugs with all the right people. Mm-hmm. And then I was told I couldn't be anything in life because I didn't sleep with all the right people. And then I was told, and then I was told, and then I was told.
And you know
and
what?
At a certain point, you just got to look at it and go, you got to be yourself. You got to be true to yourself. And that's one of the things you and I both love about the rock band Rush.
Yep.
They have always been true to themselves.
Well, all those people telling you no, that's what makes you a Rush fan. That's what makes us
Rush
fans.
What doesn't kill us makes us stronger.
Exactly
you
right.
You got to stand up for what you believe in. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you, Donna. And we're absolutely going to do this again a lot more times. Thank you so much for your time.
I appreciate it. Have a good day.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.